Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cold Feet Podcast. Join our journey as we interview people in this cold plunge and we delve on the adventure of holistic health, athletic development, barefoot education, questioning the norm, and so much more. So dive in, grab a hot cocoa, and enjoy the episode.
Before we start our podcast episode, we would like to give a brief shout out to our podcast sponsors. Most shoes harm your mobility by over-restricting your foot's natural movement. With the Ursus from Barefoot Athletics, a shoe designed with minimal restrictions, your feet can move the way nature intended, so you can move with more confidence and strength in every step. Barefoot Shoes was founded by Chris Duffin, who attributes proper foot biomechanics as foundational to his success in squatting and deadlifting over 1,000 for reps. He created Barefoot Shoes to provide a minimal shoe designed for strength athletes. Go to barefoot.shoes/TBSR to check out the Ursus, and you can save 10% with the code TBSR10 to purchase the strongest minimalist shoe available. As a gym owner, I usually lift barefoot. When I can't lift barefoot, I love lifting in my barefoot shoes for both the health benefits of lifting barefoot and the increased ground feel I have in all my lifts. You don't need supplements to build muscle, lose fat, and get healthy, but the right ones can help. That's why over 350,000 fitness folk have chosen Legion. Well, that and their 100% natural products, their clinically effective ingredients and doses, and their no-hassle money-back guarantee. I've been following Michael Matthews, the CEO of Legion Athletics, journey since 2012, and I am super duper impressed with their supplements. They have a wide variety of everything from protein powders, pre-workouts, post-workouts, omega-3s, and bundles. And you can save a whooping 20% with the discount code HABER, H-A-B-E-R. So just log in to legionathletics.com, and the discount code is HABER for 20% off. Earthrunners are some of my favorite minimalist sandals. Earthrunners were created to rewild our lives in response to the typical modern domesticated lifestyle, which is causing numerous health, psychological, and social issues. Through rewilding and grounding, we aim to bring stronger, healthier, and more resilient individuals and communities back to our society. If you're not familiar with grounding is exposing your bare feet or body to the earth beneath you. And if you're unable to do that, you can ground with sandals like Earthrunners with their unique copper plug and copper laces. Grounding has a huge display of benefits such as reducing inflammation, improving sleep, and improving happiness. So you can check out Earthrunners at earthrunners.com, and you can use our discount code of TBSR10 to get 10% off. Not quite bone broth because I didn't make a new batch yet, but I got some green juice here. So cheers.
So we're recording now. We'll just get right into it. But we got our drinks. I got my bone broth. Sean's got his drink. And this is fitting because we are going to talk about advanced recovery methods. And Sean, you're going to find this funny. I have a hilarious story about bone broth. And I got really obsessed with it during COVID just because I got more into nourishing my body, staying hydrated, and getting good collagen. And I would always post like bone broth on my Instagram stories. And someone like personally attacked me for my bone broth and was like, yeah, Erica's all into like these conspiracy theories now and like talking all about being healthy and she drinks her bone broth. And I'm like, why do you have to hate on my bone broth? And why are you knocking me for talking about health and being healthy and resilient? So I just thought it was really funny, but like, you can't hate on my bone broth. I'm still going to drink it.
So I've kind of found is that the more you grow as an Instagram account, as a, let's just call it influencer, even though we're both performance coaches, you're going to get hated on more. It's just the amount of people you're reaching, and more hate sometimes mean that your account is reaching more people and your methodology is becoming more unique. Because if you were just some random dude in the middle of nowhere and no one ever heard of you, then no one would hate on you either. So you're going to get the hate comments. You're going to get the weird people. And guess what? They could unfollow you. They could not engage with you, think you're this weirdo hippie, and like, you've come to accept that.
I agree, Sean. And it's just really funny. And honestly, I don't consider myself an influencer. I kind of don't like that term. First of all, it's not a job title. Like, everyone's like, oh, I'm an influencer. I'm like, what does that mean? So yeah, it's interesting, but I think the more you grow or kind of change what you're doing, not everyone is going to like it or support it. But if it's good for you and you want to impact with sharing the power of having good health and being nourished and strong and hydrated and living life at a high level, I don't think that's a bad thing. So yeah, COVID was a very interesting time for that. Seemed to me that talking about a strong immune system was misinformation. And you know what? I don't care what side of the fence you are on. I'm not political at all. Everyone like assumed what I was during that time, which is just really funny. But I think when you're spreading information about taking care of your body, that's a powerful message. And I think more of our young athletes need to hear it because they're not learning things about good health in school necessarily.
Look, you're an educator. You know, your goal is to educate people. So it goes back to sentence one. People are going to like what you have to say. People are not going to like what you have to say. And that's okay. And we have to embrace that. The more reach we get as educators, I'm substituting the word influencer because I don't really like it either. But the more reach we get on all our platforms, whatever it may be, the more people are going to influence or be taught by us. And they don't have to agree with us. And, you know, we have to come to peace with that. That's okay. That's not a bad thing.
Amen. Well, that was a fun little intro. We'll keep that one. We're not going to edit that out. But let's get into today's topic. You've been on the podcast before and just kind of reintroduce yourself and what level you're working at now and where you are currently.
So first of all, it's a pleasure to be here again. I think it's our fourth collaboration together. So we must have good chemistry. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. My name is Sean. I currently live in Israel. I'm the head performance coach of Team Israel and Flag Football. So at the moment, I'm working with the adult men's team, the adult women's team, the U17 men's team, the U17 women's team, the co-ed U15 team, and the outstanding athletes of the whole program, giving them some extra love in the gym. The outstanding athletes program specifically are athletes who are in the military, but are given extra time off to train to excel in their athletic career as well. In addition to that, I also own a performance facility here in Jerusalem where I work privately with athletes as well. And thirdly, I work with virtually via app with athletes all around the world where I coach them, make them custom-made programs, and just help them become the most physically strong, but also mentally, emotionally, and spiritually strong version of themselves.
I love what you do, Sean, because you put everything together and you do way more than just the physical side of performance. And you talk about things like nutrition, mental well-being, but also purpose and that spiritual side of it. And I think that is so important for our athletes to have. And we might get into that today. But last time you were on, we talked about the bare minimum recovery you should be doing. And I saw a tweet from a sports scientist that I really respect, and he made a really good point, and it made me kind of change my mind about nutrition and sleep. But we always say it's recovery to nourish your body, to get quality sleep. But he said that those two are just essential things we should be doing anyway for human health. We shouldn't be calling them recovery. They're just the bare minimum. We need them to survive. And I thought that was such a good point. But I also think that a lot of our young athletes aren't nailing those two down, which is why we have to bring them into the recovery conversation, because our athletes think you can just throw on an ice pack or pop an Advil if you're sore or hurt, and they don't have the nutrition and sleep component. So I totally saw his point, but I think when talking to young athletes, they need to be educated on how those two are part of recovery.
Going back to the big guns, nutrition, sleep, and let's just say water intake, hydration, without them, anything else you do, the smaller guns we're going to be speaking about today, or the medium guns, the artillery, the tanks, they're not actually going to be as effective. Your ability to train is only as good as your ability to recover, and you can't outperform, you know, your food. You can't outperform your sleep. It doesn't matter how many massages you do a week, or how much mobility you do, or how much sunshine you get, if you're not getting that crucial 8 hours a night. So at least. So if you're not sure that you're doing that, go back to our other podcast episode and please give it a good listen. And follow those essentials. I think today we wanted to dive into advanced tools for either athletes who are really, really working hard and just want to maximize their recovery time, and or people who are either suffering with an injury or just not feeling like they're recovering adequately. I'm sure athletes come to you all the time and say, hey, I just like, my body's like always sore and I'm just not, it takes me 3 days to recover from a weekend soccer match. And that's where we have to say, okay, your sleep is in check, your nutrition is in check, you're drinking enough, your program volume is good. What other things can I add to your arsenal?
I think it's important to just reiterate to everyone that the methods we're about to go into today are advanced. They're the icing on the cake. They're just getting that extra edge in your recovery. But like Sean said, if you don't have the basics of nutrition and sleep nailed down, then don't jump to these first. Get the big rocks down, and then you can start to add the icing on the cake. But what we're about to talk to today are some of the most researched advanced recovery methods for those higher level athletes who are ready to do these. So let's first talk about cold immersion, maybe explain the difference between immersion and then like cold showers, which one's appropriate for what. So yeah, let's get into it.
Let's dive in. Okay. So first of all, cold exposure is generally done wrong. I think we have this image of, you know, straight out of the lacrosse tournament or the soccer match, they're jumping straight into an ice bath on the field with their friends. CrossFit tournament, same concept. You see these athletes like ice bath right after they did 50,000 burpees. And then a few hours later, they actually have another competition. So what it's doing there is saying, Erica, D1 athlete, right? Former D1 athlete. I don't care. I'm your conscience. I don't care right now about the damage that's being done to your body. All I care about is winning the gold medal. So I'm going to, you know, freeze my body, just let myself push until I can finish this 3-day tournament or until I can finish this multiple day match. And then when I get home or back to my home country, then I'll deal with the consequences of, wait a minute, did my body actually recover at all from this soccer tournament? That's what happens when you immediately do cold after a session. Your body just kind of like freezes its state. That is not the most efficient way to recover because you're focusing on your short-term ability. Let me just, you know, limp my way to the finish line, win the gold medal, get the $1 million and go home, versus your body's long-term ability to recover. So what I prefer to do is cold exposure, either on your complete rest days when there's no session, strenuous session scheduled, or 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours after any sort of intense training session. I also like pairing cold exposure with heat exposure. Now, both cold exposure and heat exposure, I'm not referring to direct cold exposure like an ice pack or direct heat, which both these things are not usually that effective when it comes to recovery. I'm referring to them more as general heat or general cold. So heat can refer to sunshine. Ooh, surprise. Good sunshine session in the heat, taking a walk in the heat, sauna, infrared sauna, jacuzzi, hot tub, hot bath. Cold can refer to cold shower, cold tub, ice bath, really cold day, rocking it in shorts. I know you probably don't get that much in Florida, but many other, and not so much here either, but just rocking it out in that summer getup in the winter. Both of them have amazing benefits, like, you know, increased immunity, increased white blood cell count, reducing inflammation, and best of all, especially as an athlete, increasing your hot or cold tolerance. So if you're going to be playing in a colder climate, cold exposure directly will affect your ability to tolerate the cold while you play, which is not just increased immunity and not just increased mental prep, but actual physiological adaptations that your body does when it plays in the cold. And this obviously applies to heat as well. So I've seen in my personal journey, now that I own an infrared sauna, that when I'm doing it like 3 to 5 times a week, I actually am able to play in those Friday afternoon boiling games in the summer at a much higher pace because my body has now adapted whatever physiological adaptations it has. I'm not Dr. Huberman, so I won't really go into there. I also am unable to go into there, but it really can truly be put under higher stress heat. So because they're such big guns, I like combining the hot and cold. Now, what are the best ways to go about it? So we already mentioned when to do it. That's either on your active recovery days, like in the app I use, that's Train Aerobic on Saturdays. It's long walk, nasal breathing. This is recovery day. Mobility session, hot cold exposure. So that's like an hour workout, but low intensity, not too difficult. There's 3 ways to do it. There's beginner level, which is also like kind of DIY. Do a hot cold contrast shower. And this is a great hack if you're in a hotel or traveling for tournaments or for You know, you don't really need much equipment. Put on, you know, the Tabata song, like get ready for Tabata. Are you ready? Right. Good workout. So put that on YouTube or whatever, Spotify, your favorite audio listening device, and do 10 seconds hot, 20 seconds cold, 10 seconds hot, 20 seconds cold, exactly to the tempo of the Tabata song. That way you won't have to worry. What if I do it too long? You're going to kind of be like switching the handle of the shower pretty quickly. Make sure not to burn yourself. That's a 4-minute session of increased immunity, but major, major, major increased blood flow to the sore muscles. So, and if you're feeling really brave, you could even like try to move the sore or injured joint while you're doing it. So let's say like, I don't know, your chest, your shoulder, that's at least what's showing on the Zoom screen, is sore. So while the water is pouring down on the you know, hurting, aching shoulder from that like overhead reach, try to really move that joint. That's going to do wonders for your body. Finish the session, 4 minutes, ready to hit the road. Level two would be if you have a bathtub and you can do a hot magnesium soak. Magnesium is the bonus. Magnesium flakes or magnesium oil. Do that for about 20 minutes. Make sure it's not too hot. You don't want it to be, I think the word is scalding. Scalding, yeah? Correct use of words. To touch, kind of like, you know, 105 degrees Fahrenheit is a sweet spot. Do like a 20-minute soak. Try to be present. I see so many people like when they're doing these cold tubs and hot tubs or saunas on their phones. Just enjoy the moment, man. Like you can have a book, you can put on some calming tones, but if you're on your phone the whole time, it could be your body is physiologically being exposed to this hot and cold. But are you really getting the max benefits if your mind and soul are completely elsewhere? So put your phone away, don't drop it in the water. Just close your eyes and be like, feel that heat against you. Finish the hot tub. Jump into an ice bath. Get some ice packs from your local gas station or whatever, you know, local corner grocery. Pop them in the bath. Get about 5 minutes in the tub. Ideal cold temperature anywhere between like Celsius. Anything above like between 35 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit is the sweet spot. If you don't have the cold tub, if you can't get ice because, you know, it can add up buying a bunch of ice packs, cold shower just to rinse off a couple minutes. Level three, this is for like, you know, the biohackers among us. Sauna plus ice bath, like cold, like proper cold plunge, or jacuzzi plus ice bath, or, you know, Turkish bath plus Cairo. That's like if you're in a hotel or if you have the whole DIY setup. They're all different. They're all going to give you that benefits of increased blood flow, primarily to the injured areas, increased immunity, increased cold heat tolerance, and just there's a little boost, like, you know, increased metabolism, increased mental capacity. What I like really about these is that you're doing something actively for yourself that is increasing your blood flow and circulation as opposed to just sitting on the couch. Because my philosophy is it's always better to do something within my movement capacity versus just Netflixing and just say, oh, I'm too sore, I'm too hurt, let me just sit on the couch.
I love that. And I think the physical benefits are just absolutely amazing. And there's so much science behind it. And I'll link some studies in the caption below, as well as you mentioned Andrew Huberman, and he did a 3-hour podcast on this, including the research as well. So I'll include all that in the caption if you guys want to check that out. And it kind of goes more into like what's going on physiologically and why it increases immunity and why blood flow is being increased at the cellular level. So if you're interested and want to nerd out on that, check out the studies below. Now, aside from the physical benefits, I'm very fascinated by the mental benefits you get from cold exposure, especially because plunging in a cold bath or even taking a 2-minute cold shower is very hard to do. But the more you do it, the more of that resiliency you develop and becomes more mental than anything. So let's get into the mental benefits of this, because I think this is really powerful for high-level athletes.
So I work a lot with military here. It's in Israel, it's a mandatory draft. So there's a lot of, you know, impressionable 18-year-olds. Some of my 17-year-old football athletes, their career literally gets interrupted by the mandatory service. So we keep that high level of performance and we try to bring it to the tactical world. Now the tactical world and the athletic training world are very similar because we need people to function at their very best. The downside of the tactical is they don't sleep as much. They're not necessarily getting optimal nutrition. They're under, like, you know, very strenuous situations. So it's the benefit, it's the level of performance of the athletic world without inherently the recovery of the athletic world. So it's a very, very gray area. Like, how can I maximize recovery with little sleep, cold exposure? How can I maximize my mental resiliency? Now, mental resiliency, and this is a conversation I've had with other like combat fitness instructors, How do you build it? What is mental resiliency? Is it repeated hill sprints for 3 hours straight? Is it going for 48 hours without sleep? Is it cold exposure? And like, there's so many different methodologies out there, but one of the proven ones is squatting 100 kilo is not easy, but it's also, if you're used to it, I just threw out 100 kilo as a number, let's just say 200 pounds instead. If you're used to it, it's like, oh, cool, you know, I'm strong, I can squat heavy, I'm gonna feel my lower body the next day. Cold exposure, doesn't matter how resilient you are, every time you step into that 35 degree Fahrenheit or 5 degrees Celsius bath, you're gonna be like, I don't wanna do this, I don't wanna do this. So you have to make that switch in your head. I'm going to be uncomfortable and I'm going to be okay with it. And that first half minute is that magic window, because all the athletes, old people, young people, you know, you name it, female, male, by the way, females have much better tolerance in the cold. I've noticed that. Like, if I can statistically say every female has ever succeeded in this ice bath, whereas like half the guys jump out right away, you know. Who runs the world? But no, but
yeah,
really,
it's actually something with that. So I think what's going on there is a lot of women who are in the third phase, so the second half of their menstrual cycle, that's when their body temperature actually increases a little bit. So that might be one of the reasons why. So we're awesome.
Wow. Yes, women are awesome. Hell yeah. I never knew that. So that's like a really cool insight.
Fun fact.
That's like, you know, like highlights of the podcast. I always thought it was just women have higher pain tolerance. They go
that
through
too.
More. They go through labor. Like labor and pregnancy, like, these things are not easy. And we suffer. Us men, we just have man flus all day. You know, oh, I'm not feeling well, you know, like that. Anyways, back to top for a second. So we're crossing this mental barrier every single time we go into the ice bath. Now, I've sometimes compared ice bathing or cold exposure to a spicy food. Like when you eat jalapenos or chili peppers or habaneros or Carolina Reapers regularly, are you actually physiologically adapting to the spicy? Like, is there some change in your body? Oh, this is no longer spicy for me. Or are you just more mentally prepared for the spicy? Like, I know I can handle this. So I don't know, but I do know that with the cold exposure, you mentally prepare yourself. When you do that 135 degree ice bath, it's the same temperature for everybody. The temperature hasn't changed. Maybe your body physiologically adapted. But what you do know is that, yeah, now you have the confidence to pass that mental barrier. And all of a sudden, I don't know about soccer, but I know in football, the games like are not canceled for rain, hail, or snow. All of a sudden, you have a snowy game. And soccer's not either. If there's like a rainy day,
it's not. So when I was in college, we played in the NCAA Sweet 16. And the field was covered in snow. Like, you couldn't even see the out of bounds. And it was like 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Nice.
Game went on?
Oh, yeah. It went on and we lost because it was on their home field and we weren't used to it.
Nice. Okay. So that's a classic example of like cold exposure giving you physical tools. But we're not speaking about the, oh, I'm used to cold. Now I can play in cold. It's that every week consistently, my athletes are cold exposing themselves once to twice a week. All of a sudden, they have a game in December and like literally our football field is in the coldest valley of the city. It's just like all the rain that just flash floods there and stuff. You're playing in the coldest temperature, but like, hey, I got this. Not because your body physiologically adopted, that's Dr. Huberman, but because your body, your mind knows I'm used to cold. I'm okay with discomfort. And that's what we see with the soldiers. Like, part of the training regimen we do for them is actually put them in cold baths regularly. Nothing to do with training, but just as like a mental barrier. So when they're in that very uncomfortable space in their, you know, special forces tryout or in their year-long training or with our athletes, we'll jump back there because that's primarily what we deal with. You're just in a very uncomfortable state. It's the fourth quarter or the fourth, you know, the last few minutes of the soccer match. It depends on you to make that sprint. You're going to have to cross that mental barrier where like I'm struggling. Hey, but it's okay. But I can still do it.
I love that, Sean, and I'm glad the conversation is going this way because a lot of athletes come wintertime, they shy away from getting outside and doing their training in the cold, but they do have to get in that uncomfortable environment because that's something that they're going to enter into in some of their competitions. And A few of my remote athletes actually were doing their speed work in like 2-degree weather. And I was like, that's amazing. I mean, you should be getting uncomfortable. You should be exposing your body to this type of stimulus. And then it's just going to make that competition way easier. So for all the athletes listening, please don't shy away from this. Don't go inside a warm gym. Like, get out there and do your training and get uncomfortable.
It's generally, it's something I speak a lot about in like my podcasts, my Instagram reels. We're stuck in a comfort age, and we're also stuck in a comfort age of temperature regulation. So if most of our training sessions are in an indoor gym or in an indoor field, which is quite common these days, then you're always being exposed to perfect heat or perfect cold. It gets too cold, the heater's on. It gets too hot, the air conditioner's on, which is you never actually push your body to adapt to the physiological adaptations it needs and the mental adaptations it needs to perform in any climate, which is why, because we love like the sport-specific aspects, when a team is flying across the world to play, which happens a lot to us as a small country, we actually go a few, like people go a few weeks early. Let's get some training sessions in that climate. But I'll tell you a secret, getting 5 training sessions in a hot climate when the other team trains all year round in that climate is not enough. So we as individual athletes or as teams or as coaches have to say, how can I maximize my stimulus? Maybe not on the field. Maybe it's that hot day in the rain. I mean, sorry, it's a cold day in the rain. Maybe my athlete should go for that walk, you know, in the cold rain just to like adapt his or her body. They have to make that decision. It's not necessarily going to be up to us as coaches to know what's going on in there 24 hours a day.
I have a question about that. And I'm just trying to give what someone who would argue that would say. Mm. But what if a parent says, well, I don't want my daughter to go for a walk out in the cold rain because I don't want her to catch a cold and get sick and get the flu.
Right. Okay. So I was waiting for that. I'm going to get sick. So
I had to ask.
You know, I like that because someone's going to ask it and someone's going to, you know, what are they saying? It's propaganda stuff. So the immune system is very cool. In general, like when I was planning this podcast with you, I was like, well, recovery kind of ties into the whole immunity concept. The body doesn't get sick from the cold. The body adapts to the cold. The reason why we may get sick from the cold is because our body's in a very, very, I don't like the word weak, not strong state. And it's never, ever, ever been exposed to cold. So it's like, oh no, I'm so cold, my body's going to break down. But like any stimulus in life, we actually need to adapt ourselves slowly and progressively to cold to a point where our body is immune against it. That's how the immune system actually defends itself. So being in the cold doesn't get you sick. Having your hair wet outside doesn't get you sick. I'm trying to think of other like random examples. What could get you sick is being always in a temperature regulated environment at 24 hours, never exposing yourself to people, never exposing yourself to germs, never exposing yourself to discomfort. And then that one day doing it on an extreme, then yes, that obviously may make you feel unwell.
But so if don't, bubble wrap. Don't bubble wrap yourself.
If you do it progressively, your body's gonna develop its immune system. That's literally what the immune system is for. Before we started relying on everything else in the world except our own body's innate immune system. Propaganda.
Right. Yeah, the immune system seems to have been forgotten in the past 3 years, but shout out to the immune system and the human body for being incredibly resilient and adaptive. And that's why we're doing this podcast, because it's actually giving our young athletes empowerment back to themselves and making them realize, hey, you can train to be resilient mentally, physically, and your body is just capable of just so many feats of strength and just so many things you can overcome. And I think it's important to have these conversations, because I don't know if you find this a lot with your athletes, but there's just a lack of encouragement nowadays as far as them being powerful in their own bodies and minds. And we really need to have these conversations.
We've gotten very reliant on, I would say, systems, many things. It could be the educational system. It could be the parenting system. It could be the coaching system. But our athletes are all individuals who have to develop themselves. And if they, like, I found that the strongest, most resilient athletes are the ones who kind of like, I wouldn't say left home at a young age. That's what I did. That was kind of like an extreme. But their parents gave them complete freedom to be themselves and explore themselves. And they start forming religious opinions of like they started performing belief systems in themselves. This is what I believe in. A 14-year-old is like, yeah, I believe in God. It's not from his parents. It's from him forming his opinion on himself, believing, no, I think this is bad for me or this is good for me. Instead of waiting till the age of like 18 and 20 and their parents just constantly feeding them whatever their parents told them, the athletes never develop their opinions of themselves and they never really can grow in their self-nurturing system.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a culture where we want to bubble wrap ourselves and kind of play it safe. And yeah, I'm really glad we're having this conversation. Now, I want to come back to the cold exposure. So what are your thoughts on using it to improve the quality of sleep? Should you do a cold shower before bed, or is that going to actually hinder the sleep?
From a physiological standpoint, I can't inherently answer that, although I do know it does release lots of norepinephrine, which is one of the dopamine hormones, so the happiness hormones, and it calms your state. I've suggested it based off Dr. Huberman's work to my athletes who are struggling sleeping, and they've tried like melatonin, CBD, sleep different, like, you know, HTTP5, all these like weird different stuff because it's just not working for them. This specific athlete that I'm talking about, I told her 30 times she wasn't eating enough. But she went to all the small guns until she circled back. And I'm like, go back to eating enough. And she was fine after. But going back to the cold exposure, I think it calms your body down. At least that's what, you know, it cools your body's core temperature. And your body naturally wants to go into this cooler state as it's going to sleep. But I think it is individual for everyone. So some people, cold exposure may make them amp them up, get like really excited. And you don't necessarily want to put your body in that like hyperventilated, like Wim Hof style. Like, sorry, Mike, I'm probably breathing into the mic heavy, where you're like too amped up to sleep. So yes, many people find it effective, but it may be individual to the person. Besides the dopamine release, I don't know what else happens physiologically. Like obviously some serotonin, some happiness boosting hormones get released as well. But that's what he recommends. That's usually the protocol. Get some cold before you go to bed.
Okay. Yeah, that helps to clarify a little bit. And I think everyone does need to see if it works for them because there are some mixed reviews on that. And I imagine it would be different for men versus women based on female hormones and times of the menstrual cycle. But is there anything else that everyone needs to know about cold and hot exposure that we didn't touch on yet?
Yes. Because you asked about the like cold, like niche before sleep. So I've actually found sauna, infrared sauna specifically, to be niche after working out. And I was looking into it, like what happens physiologically. And what happens is, so infrared sauna and let's say a rock heater sauna heats the air around you. So you go into the sauna and let's say if you're doing any breath work after like 2-3 minutes, your throat starts burning because you're breathing in extremely hot air. And you can stay in around 10 minutes, depends how hot it is, 10 minutes, and then you're done. The infrared sauna directly heats your body, very similar to the sun. So you can stay for, it's the panels, like these like black panels in the sauna. It goes 6 inches deeper into the skin and it heats up your body's core temperature, which allows you to stay longer in the sauna and get the benefits for longer without overheating. So doing about a 15-minute sauna session after a strenuous workout has been shown to, and this is like studies, and I'll link them for you and for our listeners, has shown to increase testosterone and growth hormone after a strength training session. And I love reading stuff like that, but I always want to understand the why. Like, what does this? So I was thinking about it. I was speaking to a colleague of mine, and I was thinking that the body reacts to stress. So the more you push the body in training or in any other physiological way, the body's going to react and release the hormones or other glucose, protein, whatever's needed to repair itself. So I was thinking, if I do a strenuous session and then I go into the sauna, my body's still recovering from that session. Kind of like the concept of high-intensity interval training, where even during the rest time, my body's still in this very, very stressed state. So it's like trying to get, you're getting the benefits of steady, of you know, a 30 to 60-minute session, even if I'm only getting little bouts of high-intensity movement during the session. So immediately after the high stress of a strenuous field or gym session, the sauna is then putting me into an even more stressed state. It's saying not only are your muscles fatigued and, you know, broken down and your nervous system is fried, but now your temperature regulation system is fried as well. So it's putting even more stress on your body. And as long as you're recovering adequately, you manage to take your very effective gym session and make it even harder just by sitting or reading or moving ever so gently in the sauna. So that's been a cool hack. I recommend it to my athletes. I have a sauna here in my gym, and I try to use it about 4 to 5 times a week, getting that 15-minute window of high heat after your strength session.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think for the people listening, can we just clarify what growth hormone is and why it is good for muscle building after a workout?
Absolutely. So there's a few, when we work out, there's many different ways that we grow strength and grow muscle. Sometimes it's neurologically, meaning sometimes our bodies, let's say, why are there many women out there who are super strong and super athletic, but not inherently very muscular? And why is there also many men out there? Boxers, fighters, Olympic weightlifters. My Olympic weightlifting coach was 60 kilo, but I keep on saying kilo. He weighed 120 pounds, 130 pounds, and he can lift like double that over his head. How can you explain that? So his ability to recruit neurons in his body was much higher than the average person who doesn't train. And that's exactly what strength training does. It recruits more neurons. So you like fry your nervous system in order to repair it. There's also training where your muscles themselves break down and then they repair themselves. Now, in order for them to repair themselves, there has to be what's called the load, which is the working out, the repairing, which is the hormone release of growth hormone, testosterone, even in women. I know it seems like a little scary, ooh, testosterone, growth hormone. I might turn into a Arnold Schwarzenegger from one squat training session. You actually post about that a lot. I appreciate that a lot. And without these hormones, there would be no stimulus for our body to say, get better. Now, going back to sleep for a second, some of the recovery happens the immediate in terms, so like we work out, there's stress, we eat, we sit down, chill a bit, you know, drink our bone broth, some recovery happens. But the growth hormone and these other, and testosterone and insulin, which actually drives it into the muscle, it happens when we sleep. So most of our recovery is happening when we sleep. And if we don't have that hormone release, while we did have the stimulus, which is working out, there's nothing driving the glucose and nothing driving the proteins that need to be in the cells in order for repair. So without these hormones, which are like this, think of like a factory, without all the supervisors in place to shuttle everything around, we just won't recover from our workouts at all. That's why it's so important. The more we can increase these hormone levels, the faster and better we can recover. And that's also where steroidal use came in. What if I can increase my growth hormone by 300% more than normal on a consistent daily basis? Yeah, then you'll start building more muscle than the average person can without use of these excessive steroids. Now, I don't condone steroid use. What I am is explaining what the role of steroids are in the muscle recovery or general body recovery system.
I think that's a good message, that there are ways to allow our hormones to work for us. And I'm glad that you mentioned that when we sleep, that's when growth hormone increases. And that's a really good thing for all the athletes out there. So yeah, guys, this is very valuable stuff. And it's really important to consider what's going on physiologically, because I think recovery is one of the most misunderstood topics. And people kind of lean towards like the quick fixes, but from what it sounds with cold exposure, heat exposure, this is something you need to be doing consistently throughout the year, just like you're sleeping well and you're getting good nutrition year round. This is not just like, you know, one day after the game, you jump in a bath and that's it. It's a consistent practice and habit.
If there's like show notes or like some sort of summary, we could like link just the protocols, like the ones I mentioned about like Tabata, hot bath, cold bath. And then if you have the big guns, then like sauna plus ice bath, you can put the protocol there. It's simple. It's sweet. It's easy. It's sustainable. But exactly as Erica said, twice a week, like keep to it. You can't just once a year go to the sauna, go to that spa retreat, and all of a sudden your body will magically heal itself. Because unfortunately, consistency is more important than one-time big guns.
Recovery is so important, and it's really where our gains happen. And you can train as hard as you want and plow through the week, but if you are under recovering, then you are really hindering your performance. So I always tell my athletes, more isn't always better, but better is better. And it's about the quality of your training and the quality of your off days. And the best athletes, even the best CEOs and high performers and entrepreneurs, have off days.
You got it. But if you look at any like off season or even preseason soccer training regimen or any sport, it's like there could be 2 to 3 sessions a day, like, you know, soccer skills in the morning, gym in the afternoon, aerobic capacity work or speed work in the evening. Next day, gym in the morning, skills in the afternoon, agility work. Next day, we have a match. Next day, I don't believe in full off days, meaning let's say I use Traineroak, which is a software that I'm able to deliver my online programs to athletes. So if you don't program something, it will say, congratulations, you have an off day. Like it's like default coding. For me, it is always either you're training or you're actively recovering. So as I said before, things like nasal breathing, walking in the sunshine, spending time with family, go to church or synagogue or mosque or just do nothing, sit on the ground, play with your dog, cold exposure, heat exposure, prayer, singing, playing games, engaging with people. Literally, don't play a strenuous sport. In fact, many of the soccer players I work with, their coaches, I'm not talking about their performance coaches, I'm talking about their skills coaches, don't let them play other sports. So I'm not allowed to invite them to the park to toss around the frisbee, and that's understandable. That's head coach's decision. But I could invite them to the park to go for a light barefoot sunshine walk with me, because that's all more little active recovery things. And exactly as Erica said, better is better. So if I can add more recovery to my regimen, not more training, better is better. Ooh, that's a good quote.
It's a really good one. Now, nasal breathing. So I had Emily Perrin on the other week, and we did like an hour deep dive on nasal breathing. But one thing we didn't mention in that episode was that breathing through the nose with the mouth closed during wakefulness and sleep also increases growth hormone. So it's super fascinating. There's a lot of research on that as well. So it's really important to breathe well to optimize recovery.
I still remember the first time I heard about nasal breathing for sleeping. So I think it was on a podcast or a Zoom call, and she said, tape your mouth.
I do that, and I have no shame. And people think so I'm nuts, but I have never gotten better sleep and woken up more alert. I used to wake up with terrible migraines because I was a heavy mouth breather, but I am a proud mouth taper during sleep.
Yeah. So no I have a specialty, like you can use like any sort of tape, but I have the specialty ones you get on Amazon that like.
Yeah, me too.
Put in the lips. Oh, amazing. Yeah. But the first time I heard it, funny story. So the woman I was speaking to was a nutritionist. I think it was a Zoom call, like a colleague Zoom call. She's like, yeah, I'm all about mouth taping. And the people who weren't familiar with it, including myself, were like, you mean so they don't eat? Like, what is this? Torture? Like, because she didn't give, what's the word? Context. So yeah, I tape my athletes' mouths, and I'm like, that's not a good way for calorie restriction. And it was, and then we kind of like explained it. We had a whole conversation about it. That was the first time I heard about it. Just a funny story.
Yeah, it sounds a little crazy when you first talk about it, or people think you're like duct taping your mouth at night. And it's like, no, I use like the specific mouth strips that are for sleep.
Look them up on Amazon. Like, although you can use any sort of tape, just if you are using tape, I would take a little bit of coconut oil, so it doesn't like stick to your lips in the night, because I've had people report that not so fun peeling off your lips, you know?
Yep.
Just a little bit of oil to get it off easily, and it's a game changer. Just teaching yourself how to, it also helps with snoring. Yep. It helps with sore throats in the morning, which a lot of people have.
Oh, you'll yeah.
A lot more rested.
It's absolutely incredible. So if you're a snorer or mouth breather, just ask your spouse or whoever you're living with. And if you are, then strongly recommend taping the mouth during sleep, because you get more oxygen to the brain, to your muscles as well. Growth hormone is increased. And also it's really good for your dental health and not waking up with bad breath, because your nose is a filtering system and your mouth isn't. So the bacteria, if your mouth breathing, stays trapped in your mouth. And if you're doing that throughout the whole night for 8 hours, it is terrible for your teeth, your gums. You're more likely to get cavities or gum disease if you do that for a lifetime. So I know it sounds weird, but tape your mouth during sleep. It is so beneficial for so many reasons.
Mm-hmm. So I was about to jump to the next topic, but I remember that we spoke in our previous podcast about the Ninja Warrior, a friend of mine who for years of nasal breathing changed the structure of his cheekbones. How's that going for you? Getting those high cheekbones yet?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I've always had pretty like prominent cheekbones, but my friends have said that like they look a little bit stronger. And I don't know if there's truth to it. Like I've only been mouth taping during sleep and breathing through my nose during wakefulness for the past few years, being really intentional with it. I mean, I think it's going well, but that wasn't my goal with mouth taping. I just wanted to improve my sleep quality and my health. But if you do get that from mouth taping, then cool. Yeah. But your friend changed the structure of his face.
No, we spoke about this, I think, on our last podcast episode. He's one of the highest movement capacity athletes I've ever worked with. He's a pro rock climber. He trains the national climbing team. He's a ninja warrior. He almost won the finale here. Handstand artist. Like, he's master of the human body. Think like Idor Portal types. You can just do anything. I've done fun collaborations with him. I did my second ever podcast was with him, and he learned how to breathe properly. And he said how his whole face like kind of changed after years. Yeah, we're talking like 10 years of doing it as a kid. But I can link you guys. Maybe you got a cool episode together. He's a really, really cool, cool guy to have a chat with. Next big guns I wanted to jump into, and I think every professional sports team has one of these: a massage therapist, or a trainer, or team sports therapist, physio. Whatever, you know, there's a lot of like misused terms like, oh, you're a sports lady, right? You're the massage therapist. No, I'm not. That's not what I do. But people kind of confuse what the role, because a lot of like gray area of like what the support staff is. But I think on teams, they're usually called the team trainer, even though that could be a misleading term. And the art of massage therapy and soft tissue work and even like vibration therapy, like massage guns. How do those work? What do those do? How do we use them? Want to add anything to the intro or questions that our listeners may ask?
Well, so we have to pay for some of these massage modalities. So let's start with level one. So what about foam rolling? So that's probably the cheaper version of a self massage. Does that provide any benefit? Is it more mental? Let's go there first.
Yeah. Okay. So let's lump not just foam rolling, but all the devices like the cross ball, double peanut roller, foam roller, portable roller, any compression. You could even take a wine bottle and like rub yourself on it. Any sort of compression. So first of all, touch is a very powerful thing. Very powerful. So whether it's you doing it to yourself or someone else giving you a hug or whatever it is, the fact that you're giving your body that little bit of love and saying, hey, body, I care for you. Like one of the things I always do, funny, not so related, whenever I'm doing any sort of like seated hip flexion with my athletes and like I have them pick their knee up and I always say, now give your leg like a little kiss because like you work, you know, you work it pretty hard. Sometimes giving yourself that little rub with the foam roller, giving that a little extra love is a lot of oxytocin release, a lot of love hormone. That's just telling your body like, I care for you. I appreciate you. And that itself is, you can call it placebo. You can call it hocus pocus. You can say this dude's weird. That's a lot. That's a lot for recovery. So let's pretend there's no studies on soft tissue and there's no studies on foam rolling. That itself is going to give you that boost. Now, what really happens when you foam roll? A lot of, you know, different branches of what people say, but the main consensus is you're able to slightly release the fascia. And if you dig deep enough, you're also able to dig into knots in the muscle. Now, that's a little bit of a weird term. Like, what does that even mean? But the general metaphor that's given is if I have a knot in a band, like a rubber band, and I pull the muscle, which is basically like, you know, let me just do a classic stretch right here. I'm basically tightening the knot even further. So if, and this is not inherently proven, if I can release that knot or tightness in the muscle by massaging it with my various foam roller, lacrosse ball, stick, thingy, vibration gun, massage gun, will it help my enhance my performance? Yes, but only if utilizing that device will restore a healthier range of motion, which will then allow me to train. So I found that all these devices are good if used either with movement or as prep for movement. So classic example. Something that happens a lot to a lot of athletes, especially any sort of throwing or overhead athletes, And if you're a person who is listening to this podcast, just take your hands and like start like digging in your armpit, like in the back area of your armpit, not your armpit itself. You'll be like, ooh, you know, I feel a little something there. Now I can just dig in with a foam roller and a ball and it might feel good. Or as I'm digging in with the ball, I can try to start actively restoring range of motion to the shoulder. And obviously, as let's say soccer players, so you can do the same with your hips, with your glutes, with your butt, with your calves, with your knees, hamstrings. Don't just roll, but move the joint. So whatever muscle you're using, if you hamstring quads, move the knee or hip. If it's calves, shins, foot, move the ankle. If it's a chest, upper back, obliques, move either the hip or the shoulder or the elbow. Once I'm able to enhance my movement capacity, that's where the magic happens. Because if I have discomfort or pain in any joint, and then after I was able to foam or whatever, let's just call it hocus pocus for a second, whatever magical stuff happened in my body, whatever physiological changes happened in my body while I'm foam rolling, which will then allow me to move better, that's where the win happens. So either foam rolling session, some mobility, some strength training, some end range stretching, or foam rolling or soft tissue work as its own session with movement while you're rolling, while you're doing the work. I found that to be super effective. Kelly Starrett, who's considered like probably the father of like modern mobility, he has four methods. He has roll with the grain. Think of it like a steak. Apologize if you're vegan. It could be one of the impossible steaks, impossible burger steaks with more chemicals than food. Sorry.
That's so true.
With the grain. I looked at an Impossible Burger last week. It has like 17 ingredients. Steak has, especially organic grass-fed steak, it has
It's pretty nasty. Used to eat those and now I'm full on carnivore.
Hell yeah. Nice stuff. Okay. So with the grain, this is the muscle, right? So I can go with the grain. I can go against the grain. I can contract, relax, which is basically find the area of pain, push, take a deep breath, and then push deeper. Or I can move with the, I can move the joint while I'm pressing. All four of these methods, they do work. Why? Back to Dr. Huberman's show. Go to the physiology there. But they work and they're effective. And daily maintenance, 5-10 minutes a day, a few minutes before your workout, roll out your feet while you're brushing your teeth, roll your armpit while you're waiting for the coach to show up to the field, is more important than the monthly massage session, than the working with the trainer for 5 minutes before your session. Because the daily maintenance is keeping you supple, keeping your joints healthy, keeping the, if you know my ankle and hip are always hurting, rolling out there is very, very specific to your needs. It's much more efficient than just like hitting up the clinic once every now and then. Like working out 3-4 times a week versus doing a strenuous session once a month.
I do want to just make it clear to everyone that foam rolling does have its benefits. But again, what we said earlier in the conversation, you cannot out foam roll sleep deprivation, a terrible diet, or if you're training 7 days a week with no off days. You have to remember that recovery encompasses all these things, and these are just the extra.
It's the extra 10. It really is. It's going to give you some benefits, but, and now we also get into the coaching aspect. If you're a coach and you have 60 minutes or 45 minutes with your athletes twice a week, which is like probably an average of what I have with my athletes on the field, I wouldn't call it waste time. I'm not going to spend time foam rolling. I will say to them, hey, if you're here early, here's the 5-minute foam mobility roller warm-up for my YouTube channel. Here's the 10-minute ground-based mobility routine. And the second we start our warm-up, join the dynamic routine. That way the athletes who want to put in the extra work can, and the athletes who cannot, so you have to deal with what you have. But there is still bigger bang for your buck things like mobility and strength training in a full range of motion will probably give you bigger results than just foam rolling alone. But but obviously foam rolling and strength training and, you know, doing it all together will give you some, that extra 2%, which you may be lacking to recover.
That's really important point there, because I think when people think about foam rolling, they believe they have to do it for an hour, but just that 3 to 5 minutes at the beginning of a strength session a couple times a week for the whole year is so powerful, and that just compounds over time. So I'm really glad you mentioned that. Now, let's talk about how strength training comes into recovery, because a lot of athletes who don't do strength training, who don't keep their muscles resilient year round, are the ones who tend to have more muscle soreness and fatigue. So how does strength training play a role in that tissue tolerance and that improved recovery?
So it's pretty simple. The body's extremely smart at adapting. That's exactly why this whole conversation has basically been about adaptation. Cold exposure, adapting, heat exposure, adapting, soft tissue work. Eventually you'll get to a point where you no longer need to foam roll that area because the tissues of that muscle have adapted to compression. So with strength training, the more I train efficiently, not just, oh, let me one day do a little bit of this, next day do my brother's CrossFit workout of the day. The more I progressively load my body, the more resilient it becomes to any stimulus it will face. Now, the goal of the strength coach or the strength and speed coach, the goal of the performance coach of the team or individual athlete is to try to get them to have their physical readiness at what I call 1,000, which means not only just make them strong, because if she's strong, she may win the powerlifting competition, but after running 50 repeated sprints in her soccer match or her football match, she or he will just be so sore that she can't participate in practice 2 days later. So our goal with the strength training is build them to a point where their body's so used to that load that actually strength becomes recovery. So by doing that squat session 2 days before the match, I'm reminding my body, hey, you know what it's like to be loaded. You know what it's like to squat 100 kilos. You know what it's like to sprint up and down the hill. You know what it's like to deaccelerate quickly under load and shift your whole body and pivot in 80 degree heat. And that's what strength training is. And even more so, on recovery days or active recovery days, there is nothing wrong with continuing to train. Now, I don't mean loading heavy because your body may not be ready for that, but doing a light kettlebell circuit or doing a light mobility flow or even squatting 40% of what your body is capable of is reinforcing your body's body to say, hey, stimulus is good. Stimulus is okay. And the more you do that year round and the less true complete off season you take, the better your body will bounce back from practically anything. And that's why, despite this podcast being on recovery, strength training is the base of everything. So there's only what to recover from if I'm actually rigorously training. And if I'm only performing, if I'm only playing the soccer matches, or if I'm only playing the flag football tournaments or doing the special forces tryouts, all I'm doing is doing the hardest possible workouts, like the soccer match, 3 hours long, whatever it is, or a 3-day tournament flag football. I'm pushing myself to my absolute limit with zero progressively overloaded, progressively building time to get to that point. And that getting to that point is that magic pill of recovery.
And doing all those sports without the strength training, you're only just breaking the body down more and more with these repetitive movements. And eventually there needs to be a new stimulus that comes into play to truly get that athlete strong and resilient. And I don't know if you've heard of Dr. Tim Gabbett, but he's one of my favorites in load management. And he says athletes must load to handle load. And it's so simple, and I love it. And the whole theme of this podcast has been putting the body under stress in order for it to adapt and get stronger physically and mentally. So I think it's been just a really great conversation, and I'm really glad we brought strength into recovery because a lot of people don't put those two together.
It's a full regimen. Like if you do the pie graph, I think it goes hand in hand. If you strength train a lot, you're going to need to recover a lot. But in order to recover a lot, you have to strength train. You have to do some sort of rigorous training in addition to the skills work. Skills work is not strength training. A ball doesn't have to be in every drill. And like, you have to max capacity yourself. You have to full sprint without a ball. You have to lift heavy stuff in whatever form or manner without a ball on your head, because that's not going to make you a better soccer player either way or any sport.
That's a good point with the skills training. I'm not against it, but I think a lot of skill sessions really miss the mark and good physical preparation. And it's too much of that light to moderate intensity. And there's so much crossover with what's happening at sports practice that the athlete is not really getting stronger or getting more resilient to high speed running. And it's just so funny. Like yesterday at our speed session, the athletes were just like flying and going so hard. And I couldn't help but laugh and be like, there are players out there that are never exposed to this level of max velocity work. I laughed because it's sad, but it's also truly sad because we're really hindering our athletes from injury resiliency and from getting faster and becoming more powerful. So I just thought it was interesting just observing just how much these girls were flying and really getting that high speed stimulus.
Yeah, it's nice to see. It's nice to see our athletes excel. It's nice to see them progress. But I would say like full speed, like max velocity, max effort sprints, I try to get that in like once a week at least. And like you just don't get that in the game, even in football. Maybe once in a 3-day tournament, you know, wide open touchdown, she'll run 40 yards. But that's like rare. And what if she's not even ready for that? She's never in the past 6 months ran 40 yards full speed, juking a defender. How is she going to actually do that? That's where this sprint training comes in. It improves her low to moderate intensity in the game, and it's going to unlock that superpower that she can press the accelerator button when it's needed in the game.
And this ties back into recovery, because for those speed sessions, athletes must be fresh and recovered to get the most out of it. I've had athletes in the past show up to speed sessions and they're like, oh, well, my high school strength coach just made me do full field sprints with like sleds attached to me before this session. And at that point, I'm sending you home. You're going to get nothing out of what we're about to do. Your nervous system is totally fried. Your hamstrings are on fire. You're going to get no use out of my speed session if you did all that beforehand or you had a game yesterday. I tell athletes, don't even come. It's not worthwhile. You need to be recovered.
Some of the, I think, best sports teams in the world, or just very successful, a lot of communication between all the coaches. So the physio, the performance coach, the sports therapist, the head coach, the offensive coach, whoever's involved, the administrator, the garbage man, like, doesn't matter. They're all communicating and they're all ensuring that everything's being done efficiently with adequate recovery. And this happens a lot with athletes who, let's say, are playing like in Israel. So they're playing on the national level. So they have tournaments once or twice a year around the world, but they're also playing in the local tackle league and the local flag league and the local open age tournament. So you think, oh yeah, it's great. They're getting 5 sessions a week in the gym with me and 2 field sessions, and they have their tournament in 6 months, but they're not actually off season. They're actually on season tackle, on season flag, and they have a tackle tournament a month later. So like communication is key with the athlete. Like readiness, you know, how does your body feel today? Oh, actually, we had a game this morning. Oh, today's supposed to be like a total lower body heavy session. We're not going to do that today. So communicating with the athlete, how they're feeling, communicating with the coaches, what's going on with your girl or guy, and then understanding, is this going to be an active recovery day? Is this going to be a heavy strength day? Is this going to be a moderate strength day? Understanding how to apply that is pretty key in our roles as coaches.
And these recovery methods are going to become more important as we move forward, because now sports are pretty much year round, especially at the youth level. And, you know, we could complain about overtraining and overscheduling being a problem, but I think the problem lies within not preparing our athletes enough for that load with the strength training and the speed training, and also them under recovering. I think that's where the issue lies more, and we can have them handle this crazy schedule if we do these two things over here.
It also, I think, the more load we have throughout the year, the more we have to make sure that they know the difference between sore and like good pain versus injured or bad pain. Because if they can't make that, it happens so often, they can't make that differentiation. Like, hey, why didn't you log your workouts this past week? I noticed you like didn't show up in the app. Oh, my lower back was hurting a little after I squatted, so I couldn't do the workout for 3 weeks. And oh, I can't throw the ball without my wrist or knee hurting. This literally, I had this conversation yesterday. 16-year-old athlete quarterback, very talented, and like she's really like growing. It's the first time strength training. She's like getting used to it. She's like, I can't bend my knees or bend my wrist without pain. I'm like, wow, that's tough. Let's work on that. Like, let's ditch your program. Let's modify it totally to your needs and really like modify it to you. But that's like bad. You can't bend your wrist without pain. That's bad. But then after going into it, I was like, oh, she's not in pain. She's just like, she works out and she gets very sore in her body. And like, being a young 15 or 16 year old, she doesn't understand. And like, we're working on this together, that soreness is a thing and workouts cause you to be sore. When you're sore and you have your program, you have like hopefully a good system, nutritionist, coach, sports therapist, that's building the programming in an efficient way, you should still be training. You can communicate with your coaches, hey, I'm very sore. But it's very likely after doing some mobility, after doing a little bit of light movement, you'll actually be less sore. If you're injured, then we have to like red flag, injured, let's not load too much. But we have to, coaches and parents, we have to make sure our athletes and children know the difference between that good pain, that bad pain. I'm sore, I'm a little tired, versus like my knee feels like it's going to tear if I run one more time. That's like the most important thing ever.
I do want to, I know you have to go soon to coach, but I do want to finish with your snowboarding story and how you recovered from your injury, because it's just so inspiring for any athlete out there who has been injured or is currently injured to still do something and train around it and to not just get injury free, but to come back with a stronger, more resilient body. And I truly believe injury is a time where you can come back and level up to someone greater than you were before injury. So that's why I love your story. And I want you to finish with that and share it for everyone.
I feel like this is the highlight reel. So
can't wait.
Wow. So if I can, I'm going to share a like 30-second different story about immunity, because I'm getting pings like, hey, what about immunity? Because like we keep on speaking about bone broth and like all these like hocus pocus stuff. So on Thursday, I was feeling very sick. Something was going around, and like everyone that I know, we all like went camping together, like a whole community weekend. Everyone on the weekend got sick from whatever it is.
Yeah, there's something going around here. Like my athletes were sick, except me.
Yeah. Oh, nice. So I did get sick. I had like terrible fever. 24 hours later, I wasn't at full capacity, but I was primarily back to myself. But the entire time, I was doing like every holistic possible thing to beat it. Oregano oil, bee propolis, raw honey, ginger, lemon, sunshine. I wasn't just sitting on my butt doing nothing. And I'm not at 100% yet, which is odd because I normally recover within 2 days. It's almost like 5 days later. But I'm working, I'm talking, I'm podcasting, I'm book writing. Everyone's still sick. Everyone's still lying in bed, canceling their work. I can't move from bed. And I'm like telling them, like, get out and go to the sunshine. Like, if you're going to look at yourself, oh, I'm this little, you know, frail little item, object, which your body is not, then yeah, you're going to wallow in self-misery. But if you get out and do what you can, I barely loaded this week from a strength training session because my body told me, Sean, do not load now. Because if I did some light mobility on the ground, I didn't feel so good. So I'm like, okay, this is the most I can do. Moving on to snowboard story, but just immunity and recovery, they kind of go hand in hand. Better is better. It's funny. I literally wrote in my notebook before the podcast, it's likely that more is better. It's like the same thing as you said. The more I can do to recover if I'm sick or hurt or injured, good, do it. I can't do my regular training, no problem. I can sit on the ground, do some breath work, do it. I can take my dog for a walk and that's my training for the day. That's fine. If you're injured, you're injured. Snowboarding story. So I'm Sean, and besides being a performance coach, I am a very, very avid lover of life, athlete, adventurer. I play ultimate frisbee a few times a week. I hike every week. I run barefoot every week. I strength train in the gym about 3-4 times a week. I slackline, juggle, play football, flag football, tackle football, rugby, mostly barefoot because I'm the barefoot athlete. And Sarah, me and my wife, we go regularly to snowboard every year in different European countries. And it's kind of a great outlet for us because it's not just a snowboarding trip. It's actually a break from our, I don't want to call it grind because I love what I do, but, you know, break from making Instagrams and making podcasts and training people and writing the book and running the Barefoot Tour Review. And we have lots of stress in our life. So I try to use it as an opportunity to actually have my phone off as much as possible, take a break from social media, and just be as present as I can. So there's a lot of emotional investment in these trips. 2 years ago, we had just finished the World Championships in flag football, which is level-wise, there's the Olympics, there's the World Games, which is for all non-Olympic sports, and the World Championships. So whatever we placed in that, not me as a coach, but my players, my athletes, whatever Israel places in that World Championship decides our Olympic status in 2028. 6 month training campaign, multiple teams, multiple training sessions. It was a lot of load on me. And the moment the World Championships finished, I said, okay, Sarah, let's go. We're going to Bulgaria for a snowboarding trip. And I was so excited to take this break from work that I bought myself a season pass. So like, I actually got there a week before Sarah because she had still had work that she couldn't move. I'm like, Sarah, I'm sorry. Forgive me. I need to get out of Israel. Like, I just need, if I'm home or if I'm in my office or gym, I'm working. So I just need to like pick up and go. So I picked up and went. I got myself a season pass the first day. I got myself a new board, new helmet, new boots, ready to shred. She gets it. She's a border girl too. Okay. So I'm boarding first day, you know, like there's always like a day of breaking time, like breaking and back to the slopes, breaking team boards. So I had a day or two or three of switching from goofy to regular. For those who aren't familiar, goofy is when you ride switch where you're less strong, where your other leg is in front, trying to like get out of that rut of intermediate border to advanced border. And it was a new board. I was riding goofy and I tried to like 360 on the snow, not in the air. And the board wasn't really flexible yet. So I fell with a complete outstretched hand on the mountain. This is after about 3 days of boarding and I completely pass out on the mountain. I wake up, I don't know, a few seconds later, a few minutes later to skiers like, yo, you okay, man? And I'm like, no, I'm terribly nauseous. I just blacked out in a mountain. Luckily, it was like a blue slope. I'm not doing so good, but my friend is like somewhere. I think he went ahead of me. I didn't even have service there. Remember, I didn't want to be on my phone. Can you call him and maybe he'll like come pick me up? So they call him. He goes back at the lift, comes, picks me. He's like, I was looking for you. I was waiting for the bottom. I didn't see you. So I just went up the gondola again. And he's like, what do you want to do? Do you want to call the evac, like the ambulance, snowball? I'm like, no. I'm hiking down this mountain. So it turns out after I broke my collarbone and dislocated my shoulder. So he's holding my snowboard. I'm holding my shoulder in my hand, hiking down the snow mountain, which is like pretty steep. You know, you can't really hike it down in snowboard boots, but I just did because I said to myself, the second it happened, I think I came to this like conclusion, like either I can wallow in misery for the rest of this trip and be like, oh, my hand, you know, or I just have a great time. I'm remembering it right now. So I hiked down that mountain and the entire time I was laughing. And my friend Itai, he's like, why are you laughing? I'm like, this is so much fun. I was probably having like major adrenaline.
Yeah, like, totally.
I did not feel any pain. I was more like just laughing and like just laughing, crying. I'm like, this is so much fun. We should hike instead of snowboarding all the time. So we hike down the mountain. I get to this, you know, sketchy snowboard clinic. I'm sure all of you have been, hopefully not. But if you've ever snowboarded or skied, you've probably been there once or twice. The doctor's like, some Bulgarian guy, he's like, it is, I don't know what it is. I don't know how to read x-ray. So I'm like, let me read my x-ray. I got it. So I see like a clear crack. Like it wasn't a full break, thankfully, thank the Lord, because that wouldn't have been fun. But I see a clear crack in the clavicle, which is the collarbone. And they also see that the AC joint was completely like sitting like very, very bent. So I said, look, I'm not a doctor. You're the professional here. Which by the way, completely made me lose my faith in doctors. But I already was on that train for quite a while. I think this is what it is. He's like, yes, this is probably right, you know? So my insurance didn't really kick in. I never got refunded for that visit, but he like did something with my shoulder, pushed it back in place, put me in a sling and said, no movement for 6 weeks. Keep it in a sling, keep it immobilized. And when you sleep and you have to sleep like in this kind of like dislocated way in order to prevent the bone from like not healing. At night was not fun, like lots of pain. I didn't take painkiller. I don't encourage being a hero in this space. Like if you're in terrible pain and like you're suffering, do what you gotta do, man. I personally don't wanna put painkiller in my body. So I chose to suffer rather than take painkiller, personal decision. Like I'm not promoting that. You know, I don't wanna come off as too extreme. The first few nights was very, very painful, but every single day, the first day or two I wore my sling, and I'd walk to the slopes, I'd walk to the restaurants, I walked out and about, sit out of the dogs. It was my right hand, which is my dominant hand, I went to the gym every day. The day after, I went to the gym every day. I did my mobility. I trained my left arm. By the way, because we're speaking about recovery, there is a concept of phantom limb training. So I was literally sitting on the machines that I never touched in my life and just doing like one arm chest presses, one arm rows, because I was like, hey, I can't train my right hand, but what if I can keep my mind sane by training? What if I can still train? So I was doing squat. This is not the day after, maybe like 2 days later, once like I wasn't in terrible pain, but I was biking on like the recumbent bike. I was pressing and pulling with the non-injured limb. I was doing sissy squats, pistol squats, lunges, dragon squats, all within my capacity of whatever my lower body could do. I wasn't able to put any load on my upper body because of the injury. So I just kept on doing like very, very advanced bodyweight movements. Keep in mind that a great way to maintain your strength and power without load is pistol squats, like ways to load the body that are loading your body weight. So all these sorts of like advanced variations, really starting to have fun with things that I never really tried before. Then about 3 days later, or 2.5 days later, I took off the sling and I'm like, you know what? This sling is not doing me good. I'm losing feeling in my wrist. I'm losing feeling in my elbow. My elbow's been, my elbows are stuck in this position for so long. I said, I'll just be careful. So I took off the sling and I haven't put it back. I remember the doctor said 6 weeks, no sling. And over that course of those like 3, 4, 5 days until Sarah came, I went to the sauna. I did like all the hot cold. I did sauna and hot bath every day. There was a Cairo chamber in the hotel. There was a Turkish bath. There was a jacuzzi. I did everything I could very carefully. I stayed happy. I prayed. I walked. I socialized. I worked out as much as possible. I hot cold every day. And about 3 days later, my go-getter mentality was like, okay, I don't have the slopes. I need another, I don't want a drug. I don't want to call it a drug. I need a stimulus. So I spoke to a friend of mine. The same friend was with me on that snowboarding trip. And I said, there's a hut at the top of the mountain where there's a guy who serves tea for the people who make it there. Let's do it. So we took the gondola up to like the third way point to the mountain and I hiked. I wore my barefoot hiking boots, which have very little warmth, very little traction. He brought his snowboard so we could like snowboard some of the down parts. And we hiked, I think, for like 5, 6 hours until we got to the hut. And we got to the hut, this little hut, and he served us some tea. He's like, how did you get here? Where's your equipment? And I actually had put my sling back on for the hike because I didn't want like my shoulder to move that much. He's like, what's wrong with you? So I showed him my stick. I had taken like this antique ski pole from a shop, just as like a crutch, so I wouldn't like slip, because if I slipped, it wouldn't end well for my shoulder. And I'm like, I hiked here by foot. He's like, what do you mean? Everyone who comes here, they come in snowshoes and they come in, you know, snowboard and ski pants and this. And I'm like, I just hiked here. He's like, okay, cool. So we had our tea. And then as we were hiking down, we missed the gondola. So it's like, okay, we have to hike down this mountain. 3 days after a collarbone break. And the way down is one of those like really, really bad snowboard paths, like great for skiers, but bad for snowboarders, like super icy, super windy, no real downhill. So we hiked for another like 5, 6 hours, pitch dark. I can't see. My arm is immobilized in my sling and I'm just laughing. And I'm just having the time of my life because I think I was, I don't know, this is not like a confirmed feat, but I think I was the first person to hike to that peak in Bulgaria, the Musala Peak it's called, unsupported. Meaning like no snowshoes, no gear, no snowboard, no skis, just me. And that was one of the best things I did because that set the tone for the rest of my trip because Sarah had just come the day later. She's like, oh no, you hurt yourself again? I thought you stopped playing tackle football. And I was like, babe, you have a great time. You go snowboard, hit it up with the friends. I'm just gonna hang around the hotel, work out. I'll see you in the evening. We'll have dinner together. And she still had a 2 week trip. So I wasn't going to cancel my trip and lie in misery and go back to Israel. So for the next 2 weeks, I hiked, walked, stayed sane. But that trip changed my life because not only did it show me that like you still can do many things even if you're injured, but it actually like it just set that happiness, giddiness, fun vibes for the rest of the trip. Here's where it gets better. I got back to Israel and I went to, this is the probably last time I went to a doctor. I figured maybe I should go to like a real doctor in a hospital just to get an opinion, as opposed to this dude who like probably like printed a certificate from literally like West third world countries. And the doctor's like, dude, your break is all I see is the AC joint dislocation. Like your break is like mostly healed. Like it's not even a big deal. I'm like, I showed him the old X-ray. He's like, I'll take it. He sent me the new X-ray. He's like, don't worry about it. AC joint dislocation. That's what's happening now. And he just told me like the same thing, like here, go to a PT in 2 weeks, like the regular protocol. And I think so the doctor said I have to be in a sling for 6 weeks. And 6 weeks later, I was back to doing full capacity pull-ups. 8 weeks later, I was back to overhead pressing my body weight, 80 kilo. Okay, that's, I don't know, 200 pounds. And then that winter, it snowed in Israel. So about 2 months later, 8 weeks later, same week I was able to overhead press, I brought my snowboard out and I went to the park. It's not a snowboarding park. It's just a regular park. I took my dog and I slid down the hill on my snowboard. And I said to myself, if I stayed in that sling, I would be so atrophied now. I wouldn't be able to do anything. I wouldn't be able to train. I wouldn't be able to walk. I wouldn't be able to board. 2 months later, I'm boarding. So once again, for those listening, cool story, right? This is an extreme example of someone who prioritizes their health every single day for the past 10 years. When you do that, your body gives back. It says, Sean, I got you. And when you prioritize your health every single day of that injury, what you eat, how you sleep, what you drink, immerse yourself physically, spiritually, and emotionally, stay training, I can probably guarantee you that you're going to bounce back much quicker. And I've proven it with myself. And yeah, that's it. Stop studying. Brings a lot of
emotion. Oh my gosh. That story was incredible. And I just love how the doctor was like, yeah, stay in a sling. Don't move for 6 weeks. Meanwhile, you're hiking up and down mountains practically barefoot.
Yeah,
but then you come back like stronger than you were, and your muscles didn't atrophy, and you stayed active, you kept strong. And I just think that's such a powerful message to end on and to give people who are injured hope, and hope in your body and trust in your body that you can train it. And the body is so adaptive, and that's the great news. And man, Sean, that was such a great story. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. I can't remember. I did heat cold every day. I prayed every day. I journaled every day. I breath worked every day. I can't pinpoint one of these practices and say, this is the magic fix. But if you're doing as many as you can, especially the ones we spoke about both in this podcast and previous podcasts, you're making serious changes in your body. You're definitely checking off the things you need to do to recover adequately, both through injury and through just general soreness and recovery.
I also love that you stayed positive and you were like, look, like, I hurt myself, but I'm on this trip. My wife is about to arrive too, and I don't want to ruin it for everyone. So I'm just going to do the best I can and try and make the most of it. And I just think that's also a really good message.
There's a funny ending to the story too. This will be perhaps the edited part out. So we also got Corona in the last few days of the trip. All of us, like mutual hotel Corona. And yeah, we all were sick. So I got back to Israel with Corona and they tested me in Israel because it was like before and after, and we had it. And then when I wanted to go to the hospital for my collarbone, they didn't let me because I had Corona. And I was like, no, you don't understand. Like, my collarbone's broken. I just want to get a specialist's opinion so we can, literally, I broke my bone. Like, here's my x-ray. You want to see it? Like, no, you can't. You have to stay at home and just sit on your butt for 7 days. And I was like, this is the epitome of stupidity. Because Corona's legit. I had it. I wasn't feeling well. But like, I have a broken bone. Now, most people, this would be like life or death situation. For me, I was chilling, right? But it's better to go see the doctor, even if you have Corona or pneumonia or whatever, than just sit at your home with your broken bone. So there was like this such a warped sense of health.
Yeah.
And then I got permission. I knocked on my doctor's office. I said, hey, I know I have Corona. You don't have to go near me. My mask is on. Can you let me go to the hospital, please? And then there was a waste of time, but I did it more as a precaution. Like, I didn't know what my bone was, where it was holding.
Good thing you knew how to self-heal.
Yeah.
But like, someone else in that situation would have thrown a fit. They would have been like, what do you mean you can't see me? My bone's broken. Yeah. So I think it's kind of funny. But man, this was such a great episode. And I really hope you guys enjoyed it and you were taking notes. Oh, I was taking mental notes. This was just so valuable. And I really think it's going to help people realize how strong their bodies are and just some extra things they can do on top of the basics to really maximize recovery. So thank you, Sean. And everyone, I'll see you on next week's episode.
Hey, I'm Sean and I'm the Barefoot Athlete, and I want to welcome you on this 6-week Barefoot Transition course. 2.5 years ago, we started developing this course and we wanted it to be 12 months long. Why 12 months? Because we felt that if you just spent dozens of years in cushioned shoes, you can't transition that quickly. Realizing that 12 months is not sustainable, we shortened it to 6 weeks. And in these 6 weeks, you're going to dive into foot, knee, ankle, hip, shoulder mobility. You're going to dive into calf, ankle, knee, hip strengthening. You're going to learn how to take care of your feet, how to release them with tons of soft tissue work. After the first phase is over, after the 3 weeks are done, your pain is gone. Your knees, your hips, your feet are feeling great, ready to rumble. Move on to the advanced stage. We learn how to land. We learn how to jump. We learn how to produce force and absorb force. Every single week is action-packed with play, fun, challenges to challenge yourself, your friends, your loved ones, and your community. Tons of strengthening, tons of footwork, and we can guarantee you that in 6 weeks' time, you will be much, much closer to being able to fully love life and live life in minimalist footwear. And the best part of it all, you're not limited to 6 weeks. So if you want to go back and repeat a phase, you're more than welcome to. So let's go, come along, and enjoy the course.